It is quite possible that such models would eradicate the need for homework. At its best, homework served only to force the student to repeat content. If that repetition were supplied during the course of the day, there might be little need for further re-exposure. This isn't because homework isn't important as a concept. In the future school, it may simply be unnecessary. Could models like these actually work? Deliberately spaced repetitions have not been tested rigorously in the real world, so there are lots of questions. Do you really need 3 separate repetitions per subject per day to accrue a positive outcome? Do all subjects need such repetition? Might such interleaved vigor hurt learning, with constant repetitions beginning to interfere with one another as the day wore on? Do you really need review holidays? And if so, do you need them every 3 to 4 days? We don't know. Years and years. Today, students are expected to know certain things by certain grades. Curiously absent from this model is how durable that learning remains after the student completes the grade. Given that system consolidation can take years, might the idea of grade-level expectations need amending? Perhaps learning in the long view should be thought of the same way one thinks of immune booster shots, with critical pieces of information being repeated on a yearly or semi-yearly basis. In my fantasy class, this is exactly what happens. Repetitions begin with a consistent and rigorous review of multiplication tables, fractions, and decimals. First learned in the 3rd grade, 6-month and yearly review sessions on these basic facts occur through 6th grade. As mathematical competencies increase in sophistication, the review content is changed to reflect greater understanding, but the cycles are still in place. In my fantasy, these consistent repetition disciplines, stretched out over long periods of time, create enormous benefits for every academic subject, especially foreign languages. You've probably heard that many corporations, especially in technical fields, are disappointed in the quality of the American undergraduates they hire. They have to spend money retraining many of their newest employees in certain basic skills, which they often feel should have been covered in college. One of my business fantasies partners engineering firms with colleges of engineering. It involves shoring up this deficit by instituting postgraduate repetition experiences. These reinstatement exercises are instituted the week after graduation and continue through the first year of employment. The goal? To review every important technical subject relevant to the employee's new job. Research would establish not only the choice of topics to be reviewed, but also the optimal spacing of the repetition. My fantasy shares the teaching load between firm members and the academic community, extending the idea of a bachelor's degree into the workplace. This hybridization juxtaposes business professionals with researchers, ensuring that companies have exposure to the latest advances in their fields and informing researchers on the latest practical day-to-day issues business professionals face. In my fantasy, the program becomes so popular that the more experienced engineers also begin attending these refresher courses, inadvertently rubbing shoulders with the younger generations. The old guard is surprised at how much they have forgotten and how much the review and cross-hybridization, both with research professionals and younger students, aid their own job performance. I wish I could tell you all this would work. But instead, all I can say is that memory is not fixed at the moment of learning, and repetition provides the fixative. For your review, here's a summary of the chapter. Let's review the chapter. Long-term memory. Rule number 6. Remember to repeat. Most memories disappear within minutes, but those that survive the fragile period strengthen with time. Long-term memories are formed in a two-way conversation between the hippocampus and the cortex. Until the hippocampus breaks the connection and the memory is fixed in the cortex, which can take years. Our brains give us only an approximate view of reality because they mix new knowledge with past memories and store them together as one. The way to make long-term memory more reliable is to incorporate new information gradually and repeat it in timed intervals. A tutorial of the chapter is available at www.brainrulesbook.com. Sleep. Rule number 7. Sleep well, think well. It's not the most comfortable way to earn an entry in the Guinness Book of World Records, obtain an A on a high school science fair project, and meet a world-famous scientist. In 1965, 17-year-old Randy Gardner decided that his science fair project would involve not sleeping for 11 straight days and observing what happened. To the astonishment of just about everyone, he accomplished the feat, setting a world record that year for sleep loss. The project attracted the attention of scientist William Dement, who was given permission to study what happened to the teenager's mind during the week and a half he was awake. What happened to Randy's mind was extraordinary. To put it charitably, it started to malfunction. In short order, he became irritable, forgetful, nauseous, and to no one's surprise, unbelievably tired. 5 days into his experiment, Randy began to suffer from what could pass for Alzheimer's disease. He was actively hallucinating, severely disoriented, and paranoid. He thought a local radio host was out to get him because of his changes in memory. In the last 4 days of his experiment, he lost motor function, his fingers trembling and his speech slurred. Curiously, on the final day, he was still able to beat Dement at pinball, doing so 100 consecutive times. Some unfortunate souls don't have the luxury of experimenting. They become suddenly and permanently incapable of ever going to sleep again. Fatal familial insomnia is one of the rarest human genetic disorders that exists, affecting only about 20 families worldwide. That rarity is a blessing because the disease follows a course straight through mental health hell. In middle to late adulthood, the person begins to experience fevers, tremors, and profuse sweating. As the insomnia becomes permanent, these symptoms are accompanied by increasingly uncontrollable muscular jerks and tics. The person soon experiences crushing feelings of depression and anxiety. He or she becomes psychotic. Finally, mercifully, the patient slips into a coma and dies. So we know bad things happen when we don't get any sleep. But considering that sleep occupies a whopping one-third of our time on the planet, it is incredible to contemplate that we still don't know why we need to sleep. Not that there haven't been clues. One came about 10 years ago from a group of researchers who left a bunch of wires stuck inside a rat's brain. The rat had just learned to negotiate a maze when it decided to take a nap. The recording device was still attached to those wires, and it was still on. But to understand how this relates to the purpose of sleep, let's look at what the brain is doing while we sleep. You call this rest? If you ever get a chance to listen in on a living brain while it is slumbering, you'll have to get over your disbelief. The brain does not appear to be asleep at all. Rather, it is almost unbelievably active during rest, with legions of neurons crackling electrical commands to one another in constantly shifting patterns, displaying greater rhythmical activity during sleep, actually, than when it is wide awake. The only time you can observe a real resting period for the brain, where the amount of energy consumed is less than during a similar awake period, is in the deepest parts of what is called non-REM sleep. But that takes up only about 20% of the total sleep cycle, which is why researchers early on began to disabuse themselves of the notion that the reason we rest is so that we can rest. When the brain is asleep, the brain is not resting at all. Even so, most people report that sleep is powerfully restorative, and they point to the fact that if they don't get enough sleep, they don't think as well. That is measurably true, as we shall see shortly. And so we find ourselves in a quandary. Given the amount of energy the brain is using, it seems impossible that you could receive anything approaching mental rest and restoration during sleep. Even if the brain doesn't behave itself bioenergetically, other parts of the body do rest during sleep, in something like a human version of micro-hibernation. That introduces a second puzzle. Sleep makes us exquisitely vulnerable to predators. Indeed, deliberately going off to dreamland unprotected in the middle of a bunch of hostile hunters, such as leopards, our evolutionary roommates in eastern Africa, seems like a behavior dreamed up by our worst enemies. There must be something terribly important we need to accomplish during sleep if we are willing to take such risks in order to get it. Exactly what is it that is so darned important? The scientist who studied sleepless Randy Gardner made a substantial early contribution to answering such questions. Often called the father of sleep research, Dement is a white-haired man with a broad smile who at this writing is in his late 70s. He says pithy things about our slumbering habits, such as, "Dreaming permits each and every one of us to be quietly and safely insane every night of our lives." Dement studied many aspects of the human sleep cycle. What he began to uncover was this. Sleeping brains, like soldiers on a battlefield, are actually locked in vicious biological combat. The conflict involves a pitched battle between two powerful and opposing forces, each made of legions of brain cells and biochemicals with very different agendas. Though localized in the head, the theater of operations for these armies engulfs every corner of the body. This fight is sometimes referred to as the opponent process model. As Dement began to define these two opposing drives, he noticed some strange things about the war they were waging. First, these forces are not engaged just during the night, while we sleep, but also during the day, while we are awake. Second, they are doomed to a combat schedule in which each army sequentially wins one battle, then promptly loses the next battle, then quickly wins the next one, and so on, cycling through this win-loss column every day and every night. The third strange thing is that no one army ever claims final victory in this war. This incessant engagement results in the cyclic waking and sleeping experiences all humans encounter every day and night of our lives. Dement was not working in isolation. His mentor, a gifted researcher named Nathaniel Kleitman, gave him many of his initial insights. If Dement can be considered the father of sleep research, Kleitman certainly could qualify as its grandfather. An intense Russian man with bushy eyebrows, Nathaniel Kleitman may be best noted for his willingness to experiment not only on himself, but also on his children. When it appeared that a colleague of his had discovered rapid eye movement, REM, sleep, Kleitman promptly volunteered his daughter for experimentation, and she just as promptly confirmed the finding. But one of the most interesting experiments of Kleitman's long career occurred in 1938, when he persuaded a colleague to join him 150 feet underground in Mammoth Cave in Kentucky for an entire month. Free of sunlight and daily schedules, Kleitman could ask whether the routines of wakefulness and sleep cycled themselves automatically through the human body. His observations were mixed, but the experiment provided the first real hint that such an automatic device did exist in our bodies. Indeed, we now know that the body possesses a series of internal clocks, all controlled by discrete regions in the brain, providing a regular rhythmic schedule to our waking and sleeping experiences. This is surprisingly similar to the buzzing of a wristwatch's internal quartz crystal. An area of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, part of that hypothalamus we discussed earlier, appears to contain just such a timing device. Of course, we have not been characterizing these pulsing rhythms as a benign wristwatch. We have been characterizing them as a violent war. One of Kleitman's and Dement's greatest contributions was to show that this nearly automatic rhythm occurs as a result of the continuous conflict between two opposing forces. With the idea that such forces are under internal control, we can explore them in greater detail, beginning with a description of their names. One army is composed of neurons, hormones, and various other chemicals that do everything in their power to keep you awake. This army is called the circadian arousal system, often referred to simply as Process C. If this army had its way, it would make you stay up all the time. Fortunately, it is opposed by an equally powerful army, also made of brain cells, hormones, and various chemicals. These combatants do everything in their power to put you to sleep. They are termed the homeostatic sleep drive, Process S. If this army had its way, you would go to sleep and never wake up. It is a strange, even paradoxical war. The longer one army controls the field, for example, the more likely it is to lose the battle. It's almost as if each army becomes exhausted from having its way and eventually waves a temporary white flag. Indeed, the longer you are awake, the victorious Process C doing victory laps around your head, the greater the probability becomes that the circadian arousal system will eventually cede the field to its opponent. You then go to sleep. For most people, this act of capitulation comes after about 16 hours of active consciousness. This will occur even if you are living in a cave. Conversely, the longer you are asleep, with the triumphant Process S now doing the heady victory laps, the greater the probability becomes that the homeostatic sleep drive will similarly cede the field to its opponent, which is, of course, the drive to keep you awake. The result of this surrender is that you wake up. For most people, the length of time prior to capitulation is about half of its opponent's, about 8 hours of blissful sleep. And this will also occur even if you are living in a cave. Except for the unfortunate members of 20 or so families worldwide, Kleitman, Dement, and a host of other researchers were able to show that such dynamic tension is a normal, even critical, part of our daily lives. In fact, the circadian arousal system and the homeostatic sleep drive are locked in a daily warfare of victory and surrender so predictable you can actually graph it. Stated formally, Process S maintains the duration and intensity of sleep, while Process C determines the tendency and timing of the need to go to sleep. Now, this war between the two armies does not go unsupervised. Internal and external forces help regulate the conflict, defining for us both the amount of sleep we need and the amount of sleep we get. We will focus on two of the internal forces, chronotype and the nap zone. To understand how these work, we must leave the intricacies of battle for a moment and explore instead the life of newspaper cartoonists and advice columnists. Oh, and we will also talk about birds. Lark or owl? The late advice columnist Ann Landers would vehemently declare, "No one's going to call me until I'm ready," and then take her phone off the hook between 1 and 10 a.m. Why? This was the time she normally went to sleep. The cartoonist Scott Adams, creator of the comic strip Dilbert, never would think of starting his day at 10 a.m. "I'm quite tuned into my rhythms," he has said. "I never try to do any creating past noon. I do the strip from 6 to 7 a.m. Here we have two creative and well-accomplished professionals, one who starts work just as the other's workday is finished. About 1 in 10 of us is like Dilbert's Adams. The scientific literature calls such people larks, more palatable than the proper term early chronotype. In general, larks report being most alert around noon and feel most productive at work a few hours before they eat lunch. They don't need an alarm clock because they invariably get up before the alarm rings, often before 6 a.m. Larks cheerfully report their favorite mealtime as breakfast and generally consume much less coffee than non-larks. Getting increasingly drowsy in the early evening, most larks go to bed, or want to go to bed, around 9 p.m. Larks are the mortal enemy of the 2 in 10 humans who lie at the other extreme of the sleep spectrum, late chronotypes, or owls. In general, owls report being most alert around 6 p.m., experiencing their most productive work times in the late evening. They rarely want to go to bed before 3 a.m. Owls invariably need an alarm clock to get them up in the morning, with extreme owls requiring multiple alarms to ensure arousal. Indeed, if owls had their druthers, most would not wake up much before 10 a.m. Not surprisingly, late chronotypes report their favorite mealtime as dinner, and they would drink gallons of coffee all day long to prop themselves up at work if given the opportunity. If it sounds to you as though owls do not sleep as well as larks in our society, you are right on the money. Indeed, late chronotypes usually accumulate a massive sleep debt as they go through life. The behaviors of larks and owls are very specific. Researchers think these patterns are detectable in early childhood and burned into the genetic complexities of the brain that govern our sleep-wake cycle. At least one study shows that if mom or dad is a lark, half of their kids will be too. Larks and owls cover only about 30% of the population. The rest of us are called hummingbirds. True to the idea of a continuum, some hummingbirds are more owlish, some are more larkish, and some are in between. To my knowledge, no British moniker has ever been applied to those people who seem to need only 4 or 5 hours of sleep. They instead are referred to as suffering from healthy insomnia. So how much sleep does a person need? Given all our recent understanding about how and when we sleep, you might expect that scientists would come up with the answer fairly quickly. Indeed, they have. The answer is, we don't know. You did not hear that wrong. After all these centuries of experience with sleep, we still don't know how much of the stuff people actually need. Generalizations don't work. When you dig into the data on humans, what you find is not remarkable uniformity, but remarkable individuality. To make matters worse, sleep schedules are unbelievably dynamic. They change with age. They change with gender. They change depending upon whether or not you are pregnant and whether or not you are going through puberty. There are so many variables one must take into account that it almost feels as though you've asked the wrong question. So let's invert the query. How much sleep don't you need? In other words, what are the numbers that disrupt normal function? That turns out to be an important question, because it is possible to become dysfunctional with too much sleep or not enough. Whatever amount of sleep is right for you, when robbed of that in either direction, bad things really do happen to your brain. Napping in the free world. Given that sleep rhythms fight their battles 24 hours a day, researchers have studied the skirmishes occurring not only in the night, but also in the day. One area of interest is the persistent need to take a nap, and to do so at very specific times of the day. It must have taken some getting used to if you were a staffer in the socially conservative early 1960s. Lyndon Baines Johnson, 36th President of the United States and leader of the free world, routinely closed the door to his office in the mid-afternoon and put on his pajamas. He then proceeded to take a 30-minute nap. Rising refreshed, he would tell his aides that such a nap gave him the stamina to work the long hours required of the U.S. Commander-in-Chief during the Cold War. Such presidential behavior might seem downright weird, but if you ask sleep researchers like William Dement, his response might surprise you. It was LBJ who was acting normally. The rest of us, who refuse to bring our pajamas to work, are the abnormal ones, and Dement has a fair amount of data to back him up. LBJ was responding to something experienced by nearly everyone on the planet. It goes by many names: the midday yawn, the post-lunch dip, the afternoon sleepies. We'll call it the nap zone, a period of time in the mid-afternoon when we experience transient sleepiness. It can be nearly impossible to get anything done during this time. And if you attempt to push through, which is what most of us do, you can spend much of your afternoon fighting a gnawing tiredness. It's a fight because the brain really wants to take a nap and doesn't care what its owner is doing. The concept of siesta, institutionalized in many other cultures, may have come as an explicit reaction to the nap zone. At first, scientists didn't believe the nap zone existed except as an artifact of sleep deprivation. That has changed. We now know that some people feel it more intensely than others. We know it is not related to a big lunch, although a big lunch, especially one loaded with carbs, can greatly increase its intensity. It appears, rather, to be a part of our evolutionary history. Some scientists think that a long sleep at night and a short nap during the midday represent human sleep behavior at its most natural. When you chart the process S curve and the process C curve, you can see that they flatline in the same place, in the afternoon. Remember that these curves are plotting the progress of a war between two opposed groups of cells and biochemicals. The battle clearly has reached a climactic stalemate. An equal tension now exists between the two drives, which extracts a great deal of energy to maintain. Some researchers, though not all, think this equanimity in tension drives the nap zone. Regardless, the nap zone matters, because our brains don't work as well during it. If you are a public speaker, you already know it is darn near fatal to give a talk in the mid-afternoon. The nap zone also is literally fatal. More traffic accidents occur during it than any other time of the day. On the flip side, one NASA study showed that a 26-minute nap improved a pilot's performance by more than 34%. Another study showed that a 45-minute nap produced a similar boost in cognitive performance, lasting more than 6 hours. Still, other researchers demonstrated that a 30-minute nap taken prior to staying up all night can prevent a significant loss of performance during that night. If that's what a nap can do, imagine the benefits of a full night's sleep. Let's look at what can happen when we ignore these internal forces and when we embrace them. Go ahead, sleep on it. If central casting ever called you to suggest a character in history representing the archetypal brilliant but mad-looking scientist, Dmitri Ivanovich Mendeleev might be on your top five list. Hairy and opinionated, Mendeleev possessed the lurking countenance of a Rasputin, the haunting eyes of Peter the Great, and the moral flexibility of both. He once threatened to commit suicide if a young lady didn't marry him. She consented, which was quite illegal, because, unbeknownst to the poor girl, Mendeleev was already married. This trespass kept him out of the Russian Academy of Sciences for a while, which on hindsight may have been a bit rash, as Mendeleev single-handedly systematized the entire science of chemistry. His periodic table of the elements, a way of organizing every atom that had so far been discovered, was so prescient it allowed room for all the elements yet to be found and even predicted some of their properties. But what's most extraordinary is this. Mendeleev says he first came up with the idea in his sleep. Contemplating the nature of the universe while playing solitaire one evening, he nodded off. When he awoke, he knew how all the atoms in the universe were organized, and he promptly created his famous table. Interestingly, he organized the atoms in repeating groups of seven. Mendeleev is hardly the only scientist who has reported feelings of inspiration after having slept, of course. Is there something to the notion of let's sleep on it? What's the relationship between ordinary sleep and extraordinary learning? Mountains of data demonstrate that a healthy sleep can indeed boost learning significantly in certain types of tasks. These results generate a great deal of interest among sleep scientists and, unsurprisingly, no small amount of controversy. How should we define learning, they debate. Exactly what is improvement? But there are many examples of the phenomenon. One study stands out in particular. Students were given a series of math problems and prepped with a method to solve them. The students weren't told that there was an also easier shortcut way to solve the problems, potentially discoverable while doing the exercise. The question was, is there any way to jumpstart, even speed up their insights? Can you get them to put this other method on their radar screens? The answer was yes, if you allow them to sleep on it. If you let 12 hours pass after the initial training and ask the students to do more problems, about 20% will have discovered the shortcut spontaneously. But if in that 12 hours you also allow 8 or so hours of regular sleep, that figure triples to about 60%. No matter how many times the experiment is run, the sleep group consistently outperforms the non-sleep group about 3-1. Sleep has been shown to enhance tasks that involve visual texture discrimination, motor adaptations, and motor sequencing. The type of learning that appears to be most sensitive to sleep improvement is that which involves learning a procedure. Simply disrupt the night's sleep at specific stages and retest in the morning, and you eliminate any overnight learning improvement. Clearly, for specific types of intellectual skill, sleep can be a great friend to learning. Sleep loss equals brain drain. It won't surprise you, then, that lack of sleep hurts learning. In fact, a highly successful student can be set up for a precipitous academic fall just by adjusting the number of hours she sleeps. Take an A student used to scoring in the top 10% of virtually anything she does. One study showed that if she gets just under 7 hours of sleep on weekdays and about 40 minutes more on weekends, she will begin to score in the bottom 9% of non-sleep-deprived individuals. Cumulative losses during the week add up to cumulative deficits during the weekend, and, if not paid for, that sleep debt will be carried into the next week. Another study followed soldiers responsible for operating complex military hardware. One night's loss of sleep resulted in about a 30% loss in overall cognitive skill, with a subsequent drop in performance. Bump that to 2 nights' loss, and the figure becomes 60%. Other studies extended these findings. When sleep was restricted to 6 hours or less per night for just 5 nights, for example, cognitive performance matched that of a person suffering from 48 hours of continual sleep deprivation. More recent research has begun to shed light on other functions that do not, at first blush, seem associated with sleep. When people become sleep-deprived, for example, their ability to utilize the food they are consuming falls by about one-third. The ability to make insulin and to extract energy from the brain's favorite dessert, glucose, begins to fail miserably. At the same time, you find a marked need to have more of it, because the body's stress hormone levels begin to rise in an increasingly deregulated fashion. If you keep up the behavior, you appear to accelerate parts of the aging process. For example, if healthy 30-year-olds are sleep-deprived for 6 days, averaging in this study about 4 hours of sleep per night, parts of their body chemistry soon revert to that of a 60-year-old, and if they are allowed to recover, it will take them almost a week to get back to their 30-year-old systems. The bottom line is that sleep loss means mind loss. Sleep loss cripples thinking in just about every way you can measure thinking. Sleep loss hurts attention, executive function, immediate memory, working memory, mood, quantitative skills, logical reasoning ability, general math knowledge. Eventually, sleep loss affects manual dexterity, including fine motor control, except for perhaps pinball, and even gross motor movements such as the ability to walk on a treadmill. When you look at all the data combined, a consistency emerges. Sleep is rather intimately involved in learning. It is observable with large amounts of sleep. It is observable with small amounts of sleep. It is observable all the time. Of course, explaining exactly how sleep improves performance has not been as easy as demonstrating the fact that it improves performance. Given the importance of the issue to the brain rule, let's try anyway. Consider the following true story of a successfully married, incredibly detail-oriented accountant. Even though dead asleep, he regularly gives financial reports to his wife all night long. Many of these reports come from the day's activities. Incidentally, if his wife wakes him up, which is often because his financial broadcasts are loud, the accountant becomes amorous and wants to have sex. Are we all organizing our previous experiences while we sleep? Could this not only explain all of the other data we have been discussing, but also finally give us a reason why we sleep? To answer these questions, we must return to our story of the hapless rat who, 10 years ago, was unfortunate to have fallen asleep with a bunch of wires stuck inside his brain. The wires are electrodes placed near individual neurons. Hook these electrodes up to a recording device, and you can eavesdrop on the brain while it is talking to itself, something like a CIA phone tap, listening to the individual chatter of neurons as they process information. Even in a tiny rat's brain, it is not unusual these days to listen in on up to 500 neurons at once. So, what are they all saying? If you listen in while the rat is acquiring new information, like learning to navigate a maze, you soon will detect something extraordinary. A very discrete, maze-specific pattern of electrical stimulation begins to emerge. Working something like the old Morse code, a series of neurons begin to crackle in a specifically timed sequence during the learning. Afterward, the rat will always fire off that pattern whenever it travels through the maze. It appears to be an electrical representation of the rat's new maze navigating thought patterns, at least as many as 500 electrodes can detect. When the rat goes to sleep, it begins to replay the maze pattern sequence. The animal's brain replays what it learned while it slumbers, reminiscent of our accountant. Always executing the pattern in a specific stage of sleep, the rat repeats it over and over again, and much faster than during the day. The rate is so furious, the sequence is replayed thousands of times. If a nasty graduate student decides to wake up the rat during this stage, called slow-wave sleep, something equally extraordinary is observed. The rat has trouble remembering the maze the next day. Quite literally, the rat seems to be consolidating the day's learning the night after that learning occurred, and an interruption of that sleep disrupts the learning cycle. This naturally caused researchers to ask whether the same was true for humans. The answer? Not only do we do such processing, but we do it in a far more complex fashion. Like the rat, humans appear to replay certain daily learning experiences at night, during the slow wave phase. But unlike the rat, more emotionally charged memories appear to replay at a different stage in the sleep cycle. These findings represent a bombshell of an idea. Some kind of offline processing is occurring at night. Is it possible that the reason we need to sleep is simply to shut off the exterior world for a while, allowing us to divert more attentional resources to our cognitive interiors? Is it possible that the reason we need to sleep is so that we can learn? It sounds compelling, but of course the real world of research is much messier. Many findings appear to complicate, if not fully contradict, the idea of offline processing. For example, brain-damaged individuals who lack the ability to sleep in the slow-wave phase nonetheless have normal, even improved memory. So do individuals whose REM sleep is suppressed by antidepressant medication. Exactly how to reconcile these data with the previous findings is a subject of intense scientific debate. What's always needed is more research, but not just at the lab bench. Ideas. What if businesses and schools took the sleep needs of their employees and students seriously? What would a modern office building look like? What would a school look like? These are not idle questions. The effects of sleep deprivation are thought to cost U.S. businesses more than $100 billion a year. I have a few ideas ripe for real-world research. Match chronotypes. A number of behavioral tests can discriminate larks from owls from hummingbirds fairly easily. And given advances in genetic research, you may in the future need only a blood test to characterize your C-process, S-process graphs. The bottom line is this. We can determine the hours when a person is likely to experience his or her major productivity peaks. Here's an obvious idea. What if we began to match chronotypes to work schedules? 20% of the workforce is already at suboptimal productivity in the current 9-to-5 model. What if we created several work schedules based on the chronotypes of the employees? We might gain more productivity and a greater quality of life for those unfortunate employees who otherwise are doomed to carry a permanent sleep debt. We might get more productive use out of our buildings if they remained open instead of lying dormant half the night. A business of the future will need to become involved in some aspect of its employees' sleep schedules. We could do the same in education. Teachers are just as likely to be late chronotypes as their students. Why not put them together? Would you increase the competencies of the teacher? The students? Free of the nagging consequences of their sleep debts, their educational experiences might become more robust simply because each was more fully capable of mobilizing his God-given IQ. Variable schedules would also take advantage of the fact that sleep needs change throughout a person's lifespan. For example, data suggests that students temporarily shift to more of an owlish chronotype as they transit through their teenage years. This has led some school districts to start their classes later. As we age, we tend to get less sleep, and some evidence suggests we need less sleep too. An employee who starts out with her greatest productivity in one schedule may, as the years go by, keep a similar high level of output simply by switching to a new schedule. Promote naps. To embrace the midday nap zone, engineers at MetroNaps have created a nap-on-the-go device called a sleep pod. "It looks like a sperm that got electrocuted," exclaimed one person upon seeing the device for the first time. Actually, the pods are portable, glorified recliners that can fit in an office, complete with light-canceling visors, noise-canceling earphones, heat-canceling circulation coils, and, at more than $14,000 each, budget-canceling prices. The company, based in New York, has pods in four countries and is busy expanding its business. Others are bringing naps into the workplace, too. Hotels with stacked bed nap salons have sprung up all over Japan. A Boston-based researcher named William Anthony is trying to create National Napping Day, a day set aside so that everybody can take a nap. He finds that 70% of the American workforce still has to take naps in secret. The favorite clandestine venue? In the back seat of the employee's car. At lunch. What if businesses and schools took seriously the existence of nap zones? No meetings or classes would ever be scheduled at the time when the process C and the process S curves are flatlined. No high-demand presentations and no critical exams would be assigned anywhere near the collision of these two curves. Instead, there would be deliberately planned downshifts. Naps would be accorded the same deference that businesses reluctantly treat lunch or even potty breaks, a necessary nod to an employee's biological needs. Companies would create a designated space for employees to take one-half-hour naps each workday. The advantage would be straightforward. People hired for their intellectual strength would be allowed to keep that strength in tip-top shape. What other management strategy will improve people's performance 34% in just 26 minutes, says Mark Rosekind, the NASA scientist who conducted that eye-opening research on naps and pilot performance. Try sleeping on it. Given the data about a good night's rest, organizations might tackle their most intractable problems by having the entire solving team go on a mini-retreat. Once arrived, employees would be presented with a problem and asked to think about solutions. But they would not start coming to conclusions or even begin sharing ideas with each other before they had slept about 8 hours. When they awoke, would the same increase in problem-solving rates available in the lab also be available in that team? We ought to find out. For your review, here's a summary of the chapter. Let's review the chapter. Sleep. Rule number 7. Sleep well, think well. The brain is in a constant state of tension between cells and chemicals that try to put you to sleep and cells and chemicals that try to keep you awake. The neurons of your brain show vigorous rhythmical activity when you're asleep, perhaps replaying what you learned that day. People vary in how much sleep they need and when they prefer to get it, but the biological drive for an afternoon nap is universal. Loss of sleep hurts attention, executive function, working memory, mood, quantitative skills, logical reasoning, and even motor dexterity. A tutorial of the chapter is available at www.brainrulesbook.com. Stress. Rule number 8. Stressed brains don't learn the same way as non-stressed brains. It is, by any measure, a thoroughly rotten experiment. Here is this beautiful German shepherd, lying in one corner of a metal box, whimpering. He is receiving painful electric shocks, stimuli that should leave him howling in pain. Oddly enough, the dog could easily get out. The other side of the box is perfectly insulated from shocks, and only a low barrier separates the two sides. Though the dog could jump over to safety when the whim strikes him, the whim doesn't strike him. Ever. He just lies down in the corner of the electric side, whimpering with each jarring jolt. He must be physically removed by the experimenter to be relieved of the experience. What has happened to that dog? A few days before entering the box, the animal was strapped to a restraining harness rigged with electric wires, inescapably receiving the same painful shock day and night. And at first he didn't just stand there taking it. He reacted. He howled in pain. He urinated. He strained mightily against his harness in an increasingly desperate attempt to link some behavior of his with the cessation of the pain. But it was no use. As the hours and even days ticked by, his resistance eventually subsided. Why? The dog began to receive a very clear message. The pain was not going to stop. The shocks were going to be forever. There was no way out. Even after the dog had been released from the harness and placed into the metal box with the escape route, he could no longer understand his options. Indeed, most learning had been shut down, and that's probably the worst part of all. Those of you familiar with psychology already know I am describing a famous set of experiments begun in the late 1960s by legendary psychologist Martin Seligman. He coined the term learned helplessness to describe both the perception of inescapability and its associated cognitive collapse. Many animals behave in a similar fashion where punishment is unavoidable, and that includes humans. Inmates in concentration camps routinely experienced these symptoms in response to the horrid conditions of the internment. And some camps even gave it the name Gammel, derived from the colloquial German word Gammeln, which literally means rotting. Perhaps not surprisingly, Seligman has spent the balance of his career studying how humans respond to optimism. What is so awful about severe chronic stress that it can wreak such extraordinary changes in behavior? Why is learning so radically altered? Let's begin with a definition of stress, talk about biological responses, and then move to the relationship between stress and learning. Along the way, we will talk about marriage and parenting, about the workplace, and about the first and only time I ever heard my mother, a fourth grade teacher, swear. It was her first real encounter with learned helplessness. Terror and titillation. We begin with an attempt at definitions, and, as is true of all things cognitive, we suddenly run into turbulence. First, not all stress is the same. Certain types of stress really hurt learning, but some types of stress boost learning. Second, it's difficult to detect when someone is experiencing stress. Some people love skydiving for recreation. It's others' worst nightmare. Is jumping out of an airplane inherently stressful? The answer is no, and that highlights the subjective nature of stress. The body isn't of much help in providing a definition either. There is no unique grouping of physiological responses capable of telling a scientist whether or not you are experiencing stress. The reason? Many of the same mechanisms that cause you to shrink in horror from a predator are also used when you are having sex, or even while you are consuming your Thanksgiving dinner. To your body, saber-toothed tigers and orgasms and turkey gravy look remarkably similar. An aroused physiological state is characteristic of both stress and pleasure. So what's a scientist to do? A few years ago, gifted researchers Jean Sok Kim and David Diamond came up with a three-part definition that covers many of the bases. In their view, if all three are happening simultaneously, a person is stressed. Part 1. There must be an aroused physiological response to the stress, and it must be measurable by an outside party. I saw this in obvious fashion the first time my then 18-month-old son encountered a carrot on his plate at dinner. He promptly went ballistic. He screamed and cried and peed in his diaper. His aroused physiological state was immediately measurable by his dad, and probably by anyone else within a half mile of our kitchen table. Part 2. The stressor must be perceived as aversive. This can be assessed by a simple question. If you had the ability to turn down the severity of this experience, or avoid it altogether, would you? It was obvious where my son stood on the matter. Within seconds, he took the carrot off his plate and threw it on the floor. Then he deftly got down off his chair and tried to stomp on the predatory vegetable. The avoidance question was answered in full. Part 3. The person must not feel in control of the stressor. Like a volume knob on some emotional radio, the more the loss of control, the more severe the stress is perceived to be. This element of control and its closely related twin, predictability, lie at the heart of learned helplessness. My son reacted as strongly as he did in part because he knew I wanted him to eat the carrot, and he was used to doing what I told him to do. Control was the issue. Despite my picking up the carrot, washing it, then rubbing my tummy while enthusiastically saying, yum, yum, he was having none of it. Or more importantly, he was wanting to have none of it, and he thought I was going to make him have all of it. Out-of-control carrot equaled out-of-control behavior. When you find this trinity of components working together, you have the type of stress easily measurable in a laboratory setting. When I talk about stress, I am usually referring to situations like these. Flooding the system. You can feel your body responding to stress. Your pulse races, your blood pressure rises, and you feel a massive release of energy. That's the famous hormone adrenaline at work. It's spurred into action by your brain's hypothalamus, that pea-sized organ sitting almost in the middle of your head. When your sensory systems detect stress, the hypothalamus reacts by sending a signal to your adrenal glands, lying far away on the roof of your kidneys. The adrenals immediately dump bucket loads of adrenaline into your bloodstream. The overall effect is called the fight or flight response. But there's a less famous hormone at work, too, also released by the adrenals and just as powerful as adrenaline. It's called cortisol. You can think of it as the elite strike force of the human stress response. It's the second wave of our defensive reaction to stressors, and in small doses, it wipes out most unpleasant aspects of stress, returning us to normalcy. Why do our bodies need to go through all this trouble? The answer is very simple. Without a flexible, immediately available, highly regulated stress response, we would die. Remember, the brain is the world's most sophisticated survival organ. All of its many complexities are built toward a mildly erotic, singularly selfish goal: to live long enough to thrust our genes onto the next generation. Our reactions to stress serve the live long enough part of that goal. Stress helps us manage the threats that could keep us from procreating. And what kinds of sex-inhibiting threats did we experience in our evolutionary toddlerhood? It's a safe bet they didn't involve worrying about retirement. Imagine you were a cave person roaming around the East African savanna. What kind of concerns would occupy your waking hours? Predators would make it into your top 10 list. So would physical injury, which might very well come from those predators. In modern times, a broken leg means a trip to the doctor. In our distant past, a broken leg often meant a death sentence. The day's climate might also be a concern, the day's offering of food another. A lot of very immediate needs rise to the surface, needs that have nothing to do with old age. Why immediate? Most of the survival issues we faced in our first few million years did not take hours or even minutes to settle. The saber-toothed tiger either ate us or we ran away from it, or a lucky few might stab it, but the whole thing was usually over in less than half a minute. Consequently, our stress responses were shaped to solve problems that lasted not for years, but for seconds. They were primarily designed to get our muscles moving us as quickly as possible, usually out of harm's way. You can see the importance of this immediate reaction by observing people who cannot mount a thorough and sudden stress response. If you had Addison's disease, for example, you would be unable to raise your blood pressure in response to severe stress, such as being attacked by a mountain lion. Your blood pressure would drop catastrophically, probably putting you into a state of debilitating shock. You would become limp, then you would become lunch. These days, our stresses are measured not in moments with mountain lions, but in hours, days, and sometimes months with hectic workplaces, screaming toddlers, and money problems. Our system isn't built for that. And when moderate amounts of stress build up to large amounts, or when moderate amounts of hormones hang around too long, they become quite harmful. That's how an exquisitely tuned system can become deregulated enough to affect a dog in a metal crate, or a report card, or a performance review. Stress can hurt more than our brains. From sniffles to forgetfulness. In the short term, acute stress can boost cardiovascular performance, the probable source of those urban legends about grandmothers lifting one end of a car to rescue their grandchildren stuck under the wheels. Over the long term, however, too much adrenaline stops regulating surges in your blood pressure. These now unregulated surges create sandpaper-like rough spots on the insides of your blood vessels. Those spots turn into scars, which allow sticky substances in the blood to build up there, clogging your arteries. If it happens in the blood vessels of your heart, you get a heart attack. In your brain, you get a stroke. Not surprisingly, people who experience chronic stress are at an elevated risk for heart attacks and strokes. Stress also affects our immune response. At first, the stress response helps equip your white blood cells, sending them off to fight on the body's most vulnerable fronts, like your skin. Acute stress can even make you respond better to a flu shot. But chronic stress reverses these effects, decreasing the number of your heroic white blood cell soldiers, stripping them of their weapons, even killing them outright. Over the long term, stress ravages parts of the immune system involved in producing antibodies. Together, these can cripple your ability to fight off infection. Chronic stress can also coax your immune system to fire indiscriminately, even at targets that aren't shooting back, like your own body. Not surprisingly, people who experience chronic stress are sick more often, a lot more often. One study showed that stressed individuals were 3 times as likely to suffer from the common cold. People were especially vulnerable to the cold-producing virus if the stressors were social in nature and lasted more than a month. They also are more likely to suffer from autoimmune disorders, such as asthma and diabetes. To show how sensitive the immune system can be to stress, you need look no further than an experiment done with the drama department at UCLA. If you can imagine having to think all day of the most depressing things that have ever happened in your life, then acting out those feelings in front of scientists while they're taking your blood, you will have a pretty good idea of this Transylvanian research exercise. During the experiment, the actors practiced method acting, which asks you, if the scene calls for you to be scared, to think of something frightening, then recite your lines while plumbing those memories. One group performed using only happy memories, the other only sad. The researchers monitored their blood samples, continually looking for immune competence. Those people who had been working with uplifting scripts all day long had healthy immune systems. Their immune cells were plentiful, happy, readily available for work. Those people who had been working with depressing scripts all day long showed something unexpected, a marked decrease in immune responsiveness. Their immune cells were not plentiful, not as robust, not as available for work. These actors were much more vulnerable to infection. The brain is just as influenced by stress as the immune system is. The hippocampus, that fortress of human memory, is studded with cortisol receptors like cloves in a ham. This makes it very responsive to stress signals. If the stress is not too severe, the brain performs better. Its owner can solve problems more effectively and is more likely to retain information. There's an evolutionary reason for this. Life-threatening events are some of the most important experiences we can remember. They happened with lightning speed in the savannah, and those who could commit those experiences to memory the fastest and recall them accurately with equal speed were more apt to survive than those who couldn't. Indeed, research shows that memories of stressful experiences are formed almost instantaneously in the human brain, and they can be recalled very quickly during times of crises. If the stress is too severe or too prolonged, however, stress begins to harm learning. The influence can be devastating. You can see the effects of stress on learning in everyday life. Stressed people don't do math very well. They don't process language very efficiently. They have poorer memories, both short and long-term forms. Stressed individuals do not generalize or adapt old pieces of information to new scenarios as well as non-stressed individuals. They can't concentrate. In almost every way that it can be tested, chronic stress hurts our ability to learn. One study showed that adults with high stress levels performed 50% worse on certain cognitive tests than adults with low stress. Specifically, stress hurts declarative memory, things you can declare, and executive function, the type of thinking that involves problem solving. Those, of course, are the skills needed to excel in school and business. The villain, the hero. In the past few years, we have begun to understand some of the neurological mechanisms involved in this obvious assault on our intelligences. The biology behind these processes can be described as a tale of two molecules, one a villain, the other a hero. The villain is the previously discussed cortisol, part of a motley crew of hormones going by the tongue-twisting name of glucocorticoids. I'll call them stress hormones. These hormones are secreted by the adrenal glands, which lie like a roof on the top of your kidneys. The adrenal glands are so exquisitely responsive to neural signals, they appear to have once been part of your brain that somehow fell off and landed in your mid-abdomen. Stress hormones can do some truly nasty things to your brain if boatloads of the stuff are given free access to your central nervous system. That's what's going on when you experience chronic stress. Stress hormones seem to have a particular liking for cells in the hippocampus, and that's a problem because the hippocampus is deeply involved in many aspects of human learning. Stress hormones can make cells in the hippocampus more vulnerable to other stresses. Stress hormones can disconnect neural networks, the webbing of brain cells that act like a safety deposit vault, storing your most precious memories. They can stop the hippocampus from giving birth to brand new baby neurons. Under extreme conditions, stress hormones can even kill hippocampal cells. Quite literally, severe stress can cause brain damage in the very tissues most likely to help your children pass their SATs. The brain seems to be aware of all this and has supplied our story not only with a villain, but also with a hero. We met this champion back in the exercise chapter. It is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. BDNF is the premier member of the powerful group of hormones called neurotrophins. BDNF in the hippocampus acts like a standing military army with bags of Miracle-Gro, keeping neurons alive and growing in the presence of hostile action. As long as there is enough BDNF around, stress hormones cannot do their damage. As I said, BDNF is a hero. How then does the system break down? The problem begins when too many stress hormones hang around in the brain too long, a situation you find in chronic stress, especially of the learned helplessness variety. As wonderful as the BDNF fertilizer armies are, it is possible to overwhelm them if they are assaulted with a sufficiently strong and sufficiently lengthy glucocorticoid siege. Like a fortress overrun by invaders, enough stress hormones will eventually overwhelm the brain's natural defenses and wreak their havoc. In sufficient quantities, stress hormones are fully capable of turning off the gene that makes BDNF in hippocampal cells. You heard that right. Not only can they overwhelm our natural defenses, but they can actually turn them off. The damaging effects can be long-lasting, a fact easily observed when people experience catastrophic stress. You might recall the bodyguard who was in the car with Princess Diana on the night of her death. To this day, he cannot remember the events several hours before or after the crash. That is a typical response to severe trauma. Its lighter cousin, forgetfulness, is quite common when the stress is perhaps less severe, but more pervasive. One of the most insidious effects of prolonged stress is that it pushes people into depression. I don't mean the type of blues people can experience as a normal part of daily living. Nor do I mean the type resulting from tragic circumstance, such as the death of a relative. I am talking about the kind of depression that causes as many as 800,000 people a year to attempt suicide. It is a disease every bit as organic as diabetes and often deadlier. Chronic exposure to stress can lead you to depression's doorstep, then push you through. Depression is a deregulation of thought processes, including memory, language, quantitative reasoning, fluid intelligence, and spatial perception. The list is long and familiar, but one of its hallmarks may not be as familiar unless you are in depression. Many people who feel depressed also feel there is no way out of their depression. They feel that life's shocks are permanent and things will never get better. Even when there is a way out, treatment is often very successful, there is no perception of it. They can no more argue their way out of a depression than they could argue their way out of a heart attack. Clearly, stress hurts learning. Most important, however, stress hurts people. A genetic buffer. In a world as complex as the brain, is the relationship between stress and learning that straightforward? For once, the answer is yes. Out-of-control stress is bad news for the brains of most people. Of course, most doesn't mean all. Like oddly placed candles in a dark room, some people illuminate corners of human behavior with unexpected clarity. They illustrate the complexity of environmental and genetic factors. Jill was born into an inner-city home. Her father began having sex with Jill and her sister during their preschool years. Her mother was institutionalized twice because of what used to be termed nervous breakdowns. When Jill was 7 years old, her agitated dad called a family meeting in the living room. In front of the whole clan, he put a handgun to his head and said, "You drove me to this," then blew his brains out. The mother's mental condition continued to deteriorate, and she revolved in and out of mental hospitals for years. When Mom was home, she usually beat Jill. Beginning in her early teens, Jill was forced to work outside the home to help make ends meet. As Jill got older, we would have expected to see deep psychiatric scars, severe emotional damage, drugs, maybe even a pregnancy or two. Instead, Jill developed into a charming and quite popular young woman at school. She became a talented singer, an honor student, and president of her high school class. By every measure, she was emotionally well-adjusted and seemingly unscathed by the awful circumstances of her childhood. Her story, published in a leading psychiatric journal, illustrates the unevenness of the human response to stress. Psychiatrists have long observed that some people are more tolerant of stress than others. Molecular genetics is beginning to shed light on the reasons. Some people's genetic complement naturally buffers them against the effects of stress, even the chronic type. Some of these genes have been isolated. In the future, we may be able to tell stress-tolerant from stress-sensitive individuals with a simple blood test, looking for the presence of these genes. The tipping point. How can we explain both the typical response to stress, which can be quite debilitating, and the exceptions? For that, we turn to a senior scientist, Bruce McEwen, an elder statesman, smart, always in a suit and tie. McEwen developed a powerful framework that allows us to understand all the various ways humans respond to stress. He gave it a name straight out of a Star Trek engineering manual, allostasis. Allo is from a Greek word meaning variable. Stasis means a condition of balance. The idea is that there are systems that help keep the body stable by changing themselves. The stress system in the body, and its many intricate subsystems, is one of those. The brain coordinates these body-wide changes, behavior included, in response to potential threats. This model says that stress, left alone, is neither harmful nor toxic. Whether stress becomes damaging is the result of a complex interaction between the outside world and our physiological capacity to manage the stress. Your body's reaction to stress depends on the stress, on its length and severity, and on your body. There is a point where stress becomes toxic, and McEwen calls it the allostatic load. I know it as the first time, and only time, I ever heard my mother use profanity. I also know it as the time I got the worst grade in my academic career. We all have stories that illustrate the concrete effects of stress on real life. As you may recall, my mother was a fourth grade teacher. I was upstairs in my room, unbeknownst to my mother, who was upstairs in her room, grading papers. She was grading one of her favorite students, a sweet, brown-haired little wisp of a girl I will call Kelly. Kelly was every teacher's dream. Smart, socially poised, blessed with a wealth of friends, Kelly had done very well in the first half of the school year. The second half of the school year was another story, however. My mother sensed something was very wrong the moment Kelly walked into class after Christmas break. Her eyes were mostly downcast, and within a week she had gotten into her first fight. In another week, she got her first C on an exam, and that would prove to be the high point, as her grades for the rest of the year fluttered between D's and F's. She was sent to the principal's office numerous times, and my mother, exasperated, decided to find out what caused this meltdown. She learned that Kelly's parents had decided to get a divorce over Christmas, and that the family conflicts, from which the parents valiantly had insulated Kelly, had begun spilling out into the open. As things unraveled at home, things also unraveled at school. And on that snowy day, when my mother gave Kelly her third straight D in spelling, my mother also swore. "Damn it," she said, nearly under her breath. "I froze as," she shouted, "the ability of Kelly to do well in my class has nothing to do with my class." She was, of course, describing the relationship between home life and school life, a link that has frustrated teachers for a long time. One of the greatest predictors of performance in school turns out to be the emotional stability of the home. Stress in the home. I want to focus on stress in the home because it is profoundly related to kids' ability to do well in the classroom and, when they grow up, in the workforce. Let us take the all-too-common case of kids witnessing their parents fighting. The simple fact is that children find unresolved marital conflict deeply disturbing. Kids cover their ears, stand motionless with clenched fists, cry, scowl, ask to leave, beg parents to stop. Study after study has shown that children, some as young as 6 months, react to adult arguments physiologically, such as with a faster heart rate and higher blood pressure. Kids of all ages who watch parents constantly fight have more stress hormones in their urine. They have more difficulty regulating their emotions, soothing themselves, focusing their attention on others. They are powerless to stop the conflict, and the loss of control is emotionally crippling. As you know, control is a powerful influence on the perception of stress. This loss can influence many things in their lives, including their schoolwork. They are experiencing allostatic load. I have firsthand experience with the effects of stress on grades. I was a senior in high school when my mother was diagnosed with the disease that would eventually kill her. She had come home late from a doctor's visit and was attempting to fix the family dinner. But when I found her, she was just staring at the kitchen wall. She haltingly related the terminal nature of her medical condition and then, as if that weren't enough, unloaded another bombshell. My dad, who had some prior knowledge of Mom's condition, was not handling the news very well and had decided to file for divorce. I felt as if I had just been punched in the stomach. For a few seconds, I could not move. School the next day, and for the next 13 weeks, was a disaster. I don't remember much of the lectures. I only remember staring at my textbooks, thinking that this amazing woman had taught me to read and love such books, that we used to have a happy family, and that all this was coming to an end. What she must have been feeling, much worse than I could ever fathom, she never related. Not knowing how to react, my friends soon withdrew from me, even as I withdrew from them. I lost the ability to concentrate, my mind wandering back to childhood. My academic effort became a train wreck. I got the only D I would ever get in my school career, and I couldn't have cared less. Even after all these years, it is still tough to talk about that high school moment. But it easily illustrates this second, very powerful consequence of stress, underscoring with sad vengeance our brain rule. Stressed brains do not learn the same way as non-stressed brains. My grief at least had an endpoint. Imagine growing up in an emotionally unstable home where the stress seems never-ending. Given that stress can powerfully affect learning, one might predict that children living in high-anxiety households would not perform as well academically as kids living in more nurturing households. That is exactly what researchers have found. Marital stress at home can negatively affect academic performance in almost every way measurable, and at nearly any age. Initial studies focused on grade point averages over time. They reveal striking disparities of achievement between divorce and control groups. Subsequent investigations showed that even when a couple stays together, children living in emotionally unstable homes get lower grades. Careful subsequent investigations showed that it was the presence of overt conflict, not divorce, that predicted grade failure. They also do worse in standardized math tests and reading tests. The stronger the degree of conflict, the greater the effect on performance. Teachers typically report that children from disrupted homes rate lower in both aptitude and intelligence. Such children are 3 times as likely to be expelled from school or to become pregnant as teenagers, and 5 times as likely to live in poverty. As social activist Barbara Whitehead put it, writing for the Atlantic Monthly, "Teachers find many children emotionally distracted, so upset and preoccupied by the explosive drama of their own family lives that they are unable to concentrate on such mundane matters as multiplication tables." Physical health deteriorates. Absenteeism and truancy increase. The absenteeism may occur because stress is depleting the immune system, which increases the risk of infection. Though the evidence is not as conclusive, a growing body of data suggests that children living in hostile environments are at greater risk for certain psychiatric disorders, such as depression and anxiety disorders. Such disorders can wreak havoc on cognitive processes important to successful academic performance. As children grow up, the effects of stress can stay with them. Indeed, performance can take a negative hit regardless of one's age, even if you were a previously high-functioning and much-admired employee like Lisa Nowak. Stress at work. You may have heard of Lisa Nowak. She is a lethal combat pilot, decorated electronics warfare specialist, pretty smart. The government spent millions of dollars training her to be an astronaut. She was also a mother with 2 kids on the verge of divorcing her husband 1 month before her biggest professional assignment, mission control specialist for a shuttle mission. Talk about built-up stress. She put some weapons in her automobile, grabbed a disguise, even packed up a bunch of adult diapers so she didn't have to stop to use a bathroom. She then drove virtually nonstop from Orlando to Houston, allegedly to kidnap her target, a woman she thought was a threat to a fellow astronaut to whom she had taken a fancy. Instead of serving as the lead for one of America's most technically challenging jobs, this highly skilled engineer is awaiting trial on attempted kidnapping and burglary charges. She will probably never fly again, which makes this sad story nearly heartbreaking. It also makes the money spent on her training a colossal waste. But those few million dollars are minuscule compared with the cost of stress on the workplace as a whole. Stress attacks the immune system, increasing employees' chances of getting sick. Stress elevates blood pressure, increasing the risk of heart attack, stroke, and autoimmune diseases. That directly affects healthcare costs and pension costs. Stress is behind more than half of the 550 million working days lost each year because of absenteeism. Stressed employees tend to avoid coming to work at the slightest excuse, and they often show up late. Yet executives often give stress the shortest shrift. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention asserts that a full 80% of our medical expenditures are now stress-related. In a workforce where 77% report being burned out, this translates into a lot of cortisol, a lot of missed meetings, and a lot of trips to the doctor. That's not all. Prolonged stress can cause depression, which alters the ability to think, a direct assault on a corporation's intellectual capital. This injury to business productivity is threefold. First, depression hobbles the brain's natural improvisatory instincts the way arthritis hobbles a dancer. Fluid intelligence, problem-solving abilities, including quantitative reasoning, and memory formation are deeply affected by depression. The result is an erosion of innovation and creativity, just as biochemically real as if we were talking about joints and muscles. In a knowledge-based economy where intellectual dexterity is often the key to survival, that's bad news for competitiveness, for shareholder value, and the bottom line. In fact, the cost of depression to the workforce in 1990 was estimated to be $53 billion. The loss of productivity contributed the most, about $33 billion of the total. Second, those same people who have lost their creativity incur more healthcare expenses. Thus, not only does stress reduce the contributions valuable employees can make, but those same employees begin to cannibalize their company's internal resources. And it's not just mental health expenditures. Depressed individuals are at increased risk for a number of other diseases. Third, people who are burned out are often fired if they don't leave on their own, and turnover further disrupts productivity. The ugly truth is that any assault on human brain cells is an assault on competitiveness. The final tab? Statistical analyses from many studies form the same dismal picture. Stress causes companies to lose between $200 billion and $300 billion a year, a little less than $90 billion of red ink a quarter. Three things matter in determining whether a workplace is stressful: the type of stress, a balance between occupational stimulation and boredom, and the condition of the employee's home life. Business professionals have spent a long time studying what types of stress makes people less productive and, not surprisingly, have arrived at the same conclusion that Marty Seligman's German Shepherds did. Control is critical. The perfect storm of occupational stress appears to be a combination of two malignant facts: A, a great deal is expected of you, and B, you have no control over whether you will perform well. Sounds like a formula for learned helplessness to me. On the positive side, restoration of control can return groups to productivity. In one instance, a for-profit consented to be studied after agreeing to institute a control-based stress management program. At the end of 2 years, the unit had saved almost $150,000 in workers' compensation costs alone. The cost of deploying the stress management program? About $6,000. And just 16 hours of the program reduced toxic blood pressure levels for employees diagnosed with hypertension. Control isn't the only factor in productivity. Employees on an assembly line doing the same tired thing day after day are certainly in control of their work processes, but the tedium can be a source of brain-numbing stress. What spices things up? Studies show that a certain amount of uncertainty can be good for productivity, especially for bright, motivated employees. What they need is a balance between controllability and uncontrollability. Slight feelings of uncertainty may cause them to deploy unique problem-solving strategies. The third characteristic, if you are a manager, is none of your business. I am talking about the effects of family life on business life. There's no such thing as a firewall between personal issues and work productivity, however. That's because we can't have two brains we can interchange depending upon whether we are in our office or in our bedroom. Stress in the workplace affects family life, causing more stress on the family. More stress in the family causes more stress at work, which in turn gets brought home again. It's a deadly self-feeding spiral, and researchers call it work-family conflict. So you may have the most wonderful feelings about autonomy at work, and you may have tremendous problem-solving opportunities with your colleagues. But if your home life is a wreck, you can still suffer the negative effects of stress, and so can your employer. Whether we look at school performance or job performance, we keep running into the profound influence of the emotional stability of the home. Is there anything we can do about something so fundamentally personal, given that its influence can be so terribly public? The answer, surprisingly, may be yes. Marriage intervention. Famed marriage researcher John Gottman can predict the future of a relationship within 3 minutes of interacting with the couple. His ability to accurately forecast marital success or failure is close to 90%. His track record is confirmed by peer-reviewed publications. He may very well hold the future of the American education and business sectors in his hands. How is he so successful? After years of careful observation, Gottman isolated specific marital behaviors, both positive and negative, that hold most of the predictive power. But this research was ultimately unsatisfying to a man like Gottman, akin to telling someone they have a life-threatening illness but not being able to cure them. And so the next step in his research was to try to harness some of that predictive knowledge to give a couple a better future. Gottman devised a marriage intervention strategy based on his decades of research. It focuses on improving the behaviors proven to predict marital success and eliminating the ones proven to predict failure. Even in its most modest forms, his intervention drops divorce rates by nearly 50%. What do his interventions actually do? They drop both the frequency and severity of hostile interactions between husband and wife. This return to civility has many positive side effects besides marital reconstruction, especially if the couple has kids. The link is direct. These days, Gottman says he can predict the quality of a relationship not only by examining the stress responses of the parents, but also by taking a urine sample of their children. That last statement deserves some unpacking. Gottman's marriage research invariably put him in touch with couples who were starting families. When these marriages started their transition to parenthood, Gottman noticed that the couple's hostile interactions skyrocketed. There were many causes, ranging from chronic sleep deprivation to the increased demands of a helpless new family member. Little ones typically require that an adult satisfy some demand of theirs about 3 times a minute. By the time the baby was 1 year old, marital satisfaction had plummeted 70%. At that same point, the risk for maternal depression went from 25% to a whopping 62%. The couple's risk for divorce increased, which meant American babies often were born into a turbulent emotional world. That single observation gave Gottman and fellow researcher Allison Shapiro an idea. What if he deployed his proven marital intervention strategies to married couples while the wife was pregnant, before the hostility floodgates opened up, before the depression rates went through the roof? Statistically, he already knew the marriage would significantly improve. The big question concerned the kids. What would an emotionally stabilized environment do to the baby's developing nervous system? He decided to find out. The research investigation, deployed over several years, was called Bringing Baby Home. It consisted of exposing expectant couples to the marital interventions, whether their marriages were in trouble or not, and then assessing the development of the child. Gottman and Shapiro uncovered a goldmine of information. They found that babies raised in the intervention households didn't look anything like the babies raised in the controls. Their nervous systems didn't develop the same way. Their behaviors weren't in the same emotional universe. Children in the intervention groups didn't cry as much. They had stronger attention-shifting behaviors, and they responded to external stressors in remarkably stable ways. Physiologically, the intervention babies showed all the cardinal signs of healthy emotional regulation, while the controls showed all the signs of unhealthy, disorganized nervous systems. The differences were remarkable and revealed something hopeful and filled with common sense. By stabilizing the parents, Gottman and Shapiro were able to change not only the marriage, they were also able to change the child. I think these findings can change the world, starting with report cards, ending with performance evaluations. Ideas. What people do in their private life is their own business, of course. Unfortunately, what people do in their private life often affects the public. Consider the criminal history of a fellow who had recently moved from Texas to a city in the Pacific Northwest. He absolutely hated his new home and decided to leave. Stealing the car of a neighbor, the second time he had committed this crime that month, he drove the vehicle several miles to the airport and ditched it. He then found a way to fool both the security officials and the gate managers and hopped a free ride back to Texas. He accomplished this feat a few months shy of his 10th birthday. Not surprisingly, this boy comes from a troubled home. This is a fairly recent event, but if something isn't done soon, the private issue of raising this child will soon become a very public problem, and he is hardly alone. How can we capture our brain rule, that stressed brains learn differently from non-stressed brains, and change the way we educate, parent, and do business? I have thought a lot about these issues. Teach parents first. The current education system starts in first grade, typically around age 6. The curriculum is a little writing, a little reading, a little math. The teacher is often a complete stranger, and there is something important missing. The stability of the home is completely ignored, even though it is one of the greatest predictors of future success at school. But what if we took its influence seriously? My idea envisions an educational system where the first students are not the children. The first students are the parents. The curriculum? How to create a stable home life, using Gottman's powerful baby nervous system changing protocols. The intervention could even start in a maternity ward, offered by a hospital, like a Lamaze class, which takes just about as much time. There would be a unique partnership between the health system and the education system, and it makes education, from the beginning of a child's life, a family affair. First grade would begin a week after birth. The amazing cognitive abilities of infants, from language acquisition to the powerful need for luxurious amounts of active playtime, are fully unleashed in a curriculum designed just for them. Note that this is not a call to implement products in that strange industry which seeks to turn babies into Einsteins in the first year of life. A great deal of that work has not been tested, despite certain claims to improving intelligence. The small number of investigations that have been done show that some of the products are actually harmful to learning. This idea envisions a mature, rigorously tested pedagogy, which does not yet exist and is still another reason for educators and brain scientists to work together. Parents would take an occasional series of marital refresher courses just to ensure the stability of the home. Can you imagine what a child might look like academically after years of thriving in an emotionally stable environment? The child flourishes in this fantasy.